Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Susan Shand and Brian Lin. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, Thailand plans to set up a center to fight the spread of fake news on social media and the internet. Government officials have said they expect the center to open by next month. Thai rights groups and opposition parties are concerned. They fear that officials may use the new center to target and silence government critics. In elections this past March, voters returned to power the military leaders who seized power in 2014. After the vote, Thailand's armed forces arrested hundreds of people for criticizing the military and protesting the ouster of the civilian government. Some of the criticism appeared on websites or social media. Thailand's Digital Economy and Society Minister announced plans for the center 2 months ago. The country is among several Southeast Asian nations taking steps against online fake news. The state-operated National News Bureau of Thailand later reported that the center would open by November 1st. Its job is to examine fake news stories found online and react to any untruthful reports that could endanger peace and security. The center will have its own website and work with the messaging software application Line. The news bureau said the center would deal mainly with issues like natural disasters, the economy and finance, health products, and government policy. However, opposition parties and rights groups say the history of the military rulers and the government that has replaced them provide reason to worry. Sunai Pasuk is a researcher working in Thailand for the rights group Human Rights Watch. She told VOA, "There are serious concerns that the fake news center of the government will be yet another tool for censorship." People working for Thailand's Digital Economy and Society Minister told VOA that no one was available to comment for this story. Government critics are worried that the center will have the power to arrest people or take legal action against them. The Digital Economy Minister has made it clear that the center will be authorized to prosecute people with various laws, Sunai said. Artit Soriyawankul is a co-founder of the Thai Netizen Network, which speaks up for freedom of speech online. He is also worried about the planned center. Artit said that Thai officials have too often called critical opinion fake news. He added, "We found that the effort is actually targeted at those who are anti-government." Thailand is not alone. Lasa Schult is with the law department at Thailand's Thammasat University. He said that Southeast Asia has become a test ground for laws against fake news. Malaysia and Singapore have gotten the most attention for recent legislation that bans fake news. But Schult noted that other countries in the area have their own laws governing fake news. In Thailand, the Computer Crimes Act makes it a crime to share false information online. Vietnam and Indonesia have similar fake news centers.
Margaret Atwood's book, The Testaments, and Bernardine Evaristo's Girl, Woman, Other, both won the Booker Prize this week. Judges recognized the prize's oldest and first Black woman winners in a surprise double award. The two writers will split the $62,800 in prize money, the judging panel said. The award recognizes the best novel of the year, written in English and published in Britain and Ireland. Margaret Atwood won the prize in 2000 for her book, The Blind Assassin. The Testaments was published just last month. It is the sequel to the 79-year-old Canadian's best-selling 1985 novel, The Handmaid's Tale. Evaristo is the first Black woman to win the prize. Her book, Girl, Woman, Other, tells the stories of 12 people living in Britain. They are mainly female and Black. While the Booker Prize has been jointly awarded to two writers two times before, the rules changed in 1993, limiting the award to one person. The judges broke those rules, saying they could not agree on a winner between the two books. The judges chose from a list of six novels. Neither of us expected to win this, said Atwood in her acceptance speech. I would have thought that I would have been too elderly, and I kind of don't need the attention, so I'm very glad that you're getting some. It would have been embarrassing if I had been alone here, she said to Evaristo. Book lovers had been waiting for the release of Atwood's novel. It returns to the totalitarian state of Gilead some 15 years after the end of The Handmaid's Tale. Atwood has said the weakening of women's rights in some parts of the world led to her writing the sequel. The judges described it as a savage and beautiful novel. In Britain, the book sold just over 100,000 copies in its first week of release. Her novel, The Handmaid's Tale, was itself nominated for the Booker Prize in 1986. It tells the story of women who are banned from reading and writing, and those who can have children are forced into sexual slavery. Girl, Woman, Other is Evaristo's eighth book of fiction. The judging panel described the work as a must-read about modern Britain and womanhood. This is incredible. I suppose a lot of people say I never thought it would happen to me. And I will say I am the first Black woman to win this prize, said the 60-year-old British writer. I hope that honor doesn't last too long. I hope that other people come forward now, she said. I'm Susan Shand.
Google has released new Pixel smartphones that have motion sensing technology. At an event in New York City on Tuesday, Google announced the release of its new Pixel 4 smartphone. The device costs $799. A larger model, the Pixel 4 XL, sells for $899. Both are expected to be available worldwide on October 24th. In addition to new phones, the company also introduced a new laptop, wireless headphones, and improved speakers for the home. One of the most talked-about improvements in the new Pixel phones is a system called Motion Sense. The system is powered by a small radar sensor inside the device that detects movement around the phone. Google says the system can sense when a user is reaching for the phone. When this happens, Motion Sense can automatically activate the facial recognition system to unlock the device. Also, when the system detects that the user is not around, the device will turn off the screen. The technology permits users to control some phone operations by waving their hand in front of the device. This can be useful for doing things without having to pick up the phone. For example, a user can use hand movements to control music, silence the phone, turn off timers, or open new apps. Google also announced several improvements to the Pixel 4's camera system. The smartphones now have two cameras on the back. One of them is designed to produce better quality, up-close photos of subjects from farther away. The company says the camera uses machine learning to recognize people who have appeared in photos before. The system can then automatically focus on them in new photos. The Pixel 4 comes with some new built-in apps as well. One of them is an improved recorder. This app is designed to record different kinds of activities and transcribe any speech as it happens. It can also identify other sounds like music or cheering. The app permits searches within the recordings to find specific words or sounds. Another built-in app is designed to detect when a user has been in a car crash and automatically places a 911 emergency call. The app also shares where the crash happened. The system will first be available to Pixel 4 users in the United States. Device makers Apple, Samsung, and Huawei still hold a much larger share of the overall smartphone market. But Google has sought to push farther into that market and use its phones to drive more users to its profitable services. Google also announced a new version of its wireless earphones, Pixel Buds, which are seen as the company's answer to Apple's AirPods. The new model, set to go on sale early next year for $179, does away with the wire connecting the two earpieces. The Nest Mini is a smaller version of Google's smart speaker. It is set to launch next week for $49. A new laptop called Pixelbook Go was also among the new offerings Google announced in New York. The computer is set to go on sale in January, starting at $649. The company says the Pixelbook Go is designed to be easier to hold with one hand for users who are moving around or on the go. It also has improved charging abilities compared to the last Pixelbook model. I'm Brian Lynn.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. The old Republican Party of Thomas Jefferson had split into two opposing groups. President John Quincy Adams led one of the groups. It called itself the National Republican Party. Andrew Jackson, a military hero and politician, led the other group. It called itself the Democratic Party. Each party had its own newspapers. In Washington, the Daily National Journal supported President Adams. The United States Telegraph supported General Jackson. The Telegraph published accusations by Democrats in Congress against the administration. The Journal, in turn, published a pamphlet that said Jackson had fought a man, chased him away like a dog, and then stolen his wife. Jackson denied these claims. Historians still do not know how much of this story is true, but the story had a great effect on Jackson for the rest of his life. Jackson met the young woman, Rachel, at her mother's home near Nashville, Tennessee. Rachel and her husband, Louis Robards, were living there at the time. They were having marriage problems. Robards argued with his wife about Jackson. He said she and Jackson seemed too close. Robards reportedly wanted to fight Jackson with his fists. Jackson said he would face Robards not in a fist fight, but in a gunfight if Robards wished to fight like a gentleman. Robards rejected the invitation to a duel, and nothing more happened between the two men. Robards and his wife settled their differences, but a short time later, they had another dispute, and Rachel left. Court records said she left with a man, Andrew Jackson. Rachel's family said she told Robards she wanted a divorce. They said he threatened her, telling her he would carry her away by force. So Rachel's family said she decided to flee. She decided to go with some traders to Natchez in the dangerous Mississippi Territory. By now, Rachel meant a great deal to Andrew Jackson. He had fallen in love with her. When the traders asked him to go with them to Natchez to protect them, he agreed. The group left for the territory early in 1791. For his part, Louis Robards began preparations for a divorce. He allowed Rachel's family to believe that he and Rachel were no longer married. But in fact, he did not complete the necessary legal action to make the divorce final. Jackson returned from Natchez after several months. His opponents later claimed that he had married Rachel while in Natchez. They said she was still another man's wife at the time. Opponents said the couple's relationship was both immoral and illegal. They said Jackson was an adulterer for having a relationship with a married woman. And they said Rachel was a bigamist for having two husbands. But Jackson said he believed Rachel and her first husband, Louis Robards, were divorced. He said he returned to Nashville to ask Rachel's mother for permission to marry her daughter and that she agreed. Andrew and Rachel Jackson remained in Tennessee. The next 2 years were busy for Jackson. As a young lawyer, he worked hard and traveled far. Then in December 1793, Jackson said he discovered court papers showing that Louis Robards had only recently divorced Rachel. Jackson said he was shocked. As soon as possible, he and Rachel were married again, legally this time. Almost 10 years passed. Jackson became a judge and got involved in Tennessee politics. But the circumstances of his marriage remained an issue that led to arguments. For instance, a man once accused Jackson of cheating on a horse racing bet. Then the man called his wife a bigamist. Jackson killed the man in a duel. Later, in the 1828 presidential election, Jackson's opponents made Rachel's honor a campaign issue. Jackson could not duel everyone who questioned his wife's honor, so he asked a special committee of citizens to investigate his marriage and make a public report. Many people on the committee were his friends or supporters. The committee found that the Jacksons were not at fault for getting married before Rachel and her first husband were legally divorced. The pro-Jackson newspaper in Washington published the committee's report. Pro-Jackson papers also began to print vicious stories about President Adams and his wife. Anti-Jackson newspapers did not publish the committee's report. They continued to denounce the Jacksons' marriage. Historian Daniel Feller at the University of Tennessee is an expert on Andrew Jackson. He says the charges about Jackson's marriage made a good story for people to talk about, but he says other accusations were more serious. These were about Jackson's career.
The attacks that really hit home were about Jackson's unauthorized and perhaps directly against orders conquest of Florida in 1819, his sometimes savage disciplinary measures against his own troops, his declaring martial law in New Orleans and maintaining martial law in New Orleans and arresting people in New Orleans well after the War of 1812 was actually over.
All during the bitter election campaign, neither Jackson nor his opponent, President Adams, said anything about one very important issue, slavery. Adams did not want to lose what little support he had in the South and West by denouncing slavery. Jackson did not want to lose the support of some Republicans in the North by openly defending it. Adams's silence did not mean that he approved of slavery. Southerners were sure that he opposed it, and Jackson did not have to tell the South what he thought about slavery. He was a slave owner, and he had bought and sold slaves all his life. There was another important difference between the two men and their political parties. President Adams and the Republicans represented the interests of those who owned property. Many of the president's supporters felt that wealthy, property-owning citizens should control the government. Jackson and the Democrats represented the interests of the common people. They did not feel that the rich had more right to govern than the poor. The presidential election of 1828 was held on different days in the different states between October 31st and November 5th. Voters in the northern states supported John Quincy Adams. Andrew Jackson won the South. Historian Daniel Feller says Southerners did not seem bothered by opponents' fears that Jackson was mentally unstable and believed he should have unlimited power.
They were much more compelled by the image of this great man of the people, and also this great man on horseback, the hero of New Orleans.
Even President Adams recognized that Jackson was extremely well-liked.
John Quincy Adams wrote in his diary years before the election that in a popularity contest, in a political contest, no man could stand against the hero of New Orleans.
When the electoral votes were counted, Andrew Jackson received 178. President Adams received only 83. Rachel Jackson was proud of her husband, but she was not happy about the life she would have to lead as First Lady, and her health seemed to be suffering. For Mr. Jackson's sake, she said, I am glad. For my own part, I never wished it. Nevertheless, the couple prepared to move to Washington. There was little time for Rachel to rest. Then, just a few days before the Jacksons were to move, two doctors were called to the Jackson home. They found Rachel in great pain. She seemed to be having a heart attack. After a day or so, she appeared to be better. She was able to sit up and talk with friends, but her mind was still troubled about the years ahead in Washington. I had rather be a doorkeeper in the house of God, she said, than to dwell in that palace in Washington. She was referring to the presidential mansion, later known as the White House. In December of 1828, a few nights before Christmas, Rachel was sitting in a chair. Her husband had already gone to sleep. Suddenly, Rachel cried out and fell to the floor. The servants screamed. Jackson ran to the room, picked Rachel up, and carried her to the bed. But he could see that life had already left her. Witnesses said Jackson continued to sit next to her, holding his head in his hands. Rachel was buried 2 days later. 10,000 people went to the funeral. The Reverend William Hume spoke of Rachel Jackson's life. He talked of her kindness and humility, and he told how she had been upset about the personal accusations against her during the election campaign. Jackson believed those accusations were a cause of Rachel's death. His anger is expressed on the stone above Rachel's grave. One line of the inscription says, "A being so gentle and so virtuous, slander might wound, but could not dishonor." At that time, Andrew Jackson was 61 years old. He was a tall, thin man. His long face was wrinkled. Most portraits of him show a great mass of messy hair pushed back from his high forehead. Jackson's health had never really been good. He carried in his body two bullets from duels fought years before. But he was a tough man with a spirit strong enough to keep moving, even when he was grieving. He left for Washington in January 1829. A huge crowd was gathering there to meet him. They would create one of the wildest inaugural celebrations in American history. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History from VOA Learning English.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.